Maybe a little word on Hanukkah before we start. The Chazal darshan on the pasuk v'choshech al pnei tahom that v'choshech zu malchus yavan shechshichus enayim shal yisrael b'gzeroseihem. That choshech refers to malchus yavan because they darkened our eyes with their gzeros. Shahayu omrin, what were their big gzeros that they used to say? Kisvu lachem al keren ashor ein lanu chelek v'lukei Yisrael. That we have to write on the keren ashor that we have no chelek v'lukei Yisrael. Now, why specifically would they decree that we reject the Ribbono Shel Olam in writing on a keren hashor? Meaning, do we ever have like records in history of a keren hashor being used as some sort of parchment, as something that's an appropriate thing to write on? It seems like there are sugyas in Gittin about writing a get, and but come on, like, is that something that was commonly done? It seems like a bizarre demand and an ask of us, and it seems like something that's an unusual mandate to have. The ban on learning Torah, the ban on doing bris milah, you understand, they're trying to asur us from doing mitzvahs, they're trying to prevent us from doing mitzvahs. But what exactly is this unusual command? Another question, the three primary targets of Gzeres Yavan were the mitzvahs of Rosh Chodesh, Milah, and Shabbos. Now, if you're going to pick three, right, there are 613, you're going to pick three, you would imagine that the three you'd pick would be the three biggest ones, the three that represent the religion the best. Are these the three that represent the religion the best? Rosh Chodesh? How much attention? I mean, what's more important, Rosh Chodesh or Pesach? How much attention do we pay to Rosh Chodesh? Shabbos, certainly, you would put it on the list, but Milah only applies to half of Klal Yisrael. The other half of Klal Yisrael is not even involved in Milah. What exactly? I would say, I don't know, Zor give the right shvichus damim or something. If you're going to have big three, that they should make us all worship Avod Zor and kamiki le'arayis and murder people or something. I don't know. But what exactly is the connection between these three in particular? And furthermore, third question related to the parsha. Paro was looking for somebody who was very skilled at interpreting disturbing dreams, because he had disturbing dreams. So the Shtar Mashkim informs him, Vishamitanu, I was in jail, he says, and Vishamitanu nar ivri eved l'sara tabachin. There was this young guy, this kid, who was a Jew, and he used to be, used to work in the house of the Sara Tabachim, v'nesaperlo, and we told him our dreams, and he managed to interpret them, ishka chalamo pasar, and he did a great job. He really hit the nail on the head. So there was this young Jewish slave, he interpreted our dreams, and very accurate. So Rashi on the spot criticizes the Sara Mashkin. And Rashi on the spot says, arurim arashayim, she'ein tovasim shlema, that Rishayim are so terrible that even when they try to do you a favor, they're not really doing you a favor. They have to like lace it with something that's insulting. He's a Rasha. Even when putting in a good word for Yosef, he has to do it in a derogatory manner. They have to say that now, but what's so derogatory? Why are we so hard on the Sara Mashkin for describing Yosef as a Nar Ivri Evet? Which part of that is inaccurate? Which part of that description does Rashi have a problem with? He was a Nar, he was an Ivri, he was an Evet, right? I mean, there was nothing that was untrue about what he said, and then he said, and he interpreted the dreams really, really well. So what's the big deal that he gave more information on the background of the person? Why is that so terrible? So it seems that one of the Yesodos of Chanukah, perhaps the Yesod of Chanukah, just based on the name Chanukah, is that Chanukah is all about beginnings. The word Chanukah relates to chinuch, which is the consecration and the start of something new. And there's something very, very powerful about your very first few moments in any endeavor, particularly when you meet a new person and you make a first impression. There's something extremely powerful about that, your initial impression of a new person. We always knew that to be true, but more recent years, Malcolm Gladwell did the research for us. And he wrote an unbelievable book called Blink, where he tried to demonstrate just how powerful a first impression is. He had many, many examples of how decisions are made on job interviews within like a millisecond of meeting the person, and then it's just you just have to do something to either change their mind or not change their mind, but the Iker decision is with the first handshake, is like right at the beginning. That's why the psak that you got to give the dead fish handshake is a very difficult psak, because you're never going to get a job, because that's you better be really impressive after that, because you know, the first impression is so critical in terms of these things. Gladwell has in one of his books about the guy who had to choose musicians for an orchestra, and he said that he used to put up screens so that he didn't see the musicians, just so he could listen to the music. Because he said, I've been in auditions without screens, and I can assure you that I was prejudiced. I began to listen with my eyes, and there's no way your eyes don't affect your judgment. The only true way to listen is with your ears and with your heart. Meaning, whatever you see, as soon as you see it, before the music starts, you see the people playing the music, and you'll immediately be biased in one direction or another. It's an interesting application over there, in which direction the person was biased, but we'll leave that aside. But Rav Chaim Shulevitz explains that that's the reason that Dayan is not permitted to hear one side of a case before both parties are present. Dayan could be a person of impeccable integrity, and he's open-minded, and he's honest, but his perception is tainted. The waters have already been muddied if he heard one side without the other present. He will never be able to look at the other party with an unprejudiced eye. That first impression is so critical. It's one of the many reasons that I, you know, still have a problem. I know everyone tells me that I'm wrong about this, but I still have a problem with the practice of shidduch resume pictures. The concept is that the boy, or sometimes in former circles on the books, the boy's mother, you know, but really, come on, will form their first impression without having to see a live person who has, like, you know, an actual warm smile and exudes sincerity and chayin, or the opposite, or just like a mean, cold-hearted, ruthless, there's no overcoming that impression. And very often it's based on so little. So to go back to our questions, this is like the yesod of Chanukah, about first impressions, about something that is that about the importance of beginnings. You know, Rav Schachter often comments that there are certain expressions that if you're not accustomed to the slang of a particular time and place in history, you would never understand it. Meaning, you just need the context to be able to understand the words, even though you speak the language. And he always gives the example of a declaration of war that was signed, and the headline in the paper read, "Thousands drown in a single drop of ink." And you look at that and you'd say, that's ridiculous. Thousands of people can't drown in a single drop of ink. But what it was referring to was that the drop of ink that was used to sign the declaration of war was going to cost thousands of lives. But speaking, Bederech Agada, the headline writer wrote, thousands drown, and he actually used that to explain how Agadata works a lot of times. That Agadata says things that seem crazy. It seems like this is nuts. But if you understand the context and you understand what they might have meant by that, then it actually does make sense. So similarly, there are statements of Chazal that are not meant to be taken literally. You have to understand the context. And with that background, maybe Kisvu Lechem al Keren Hashar is better understood. If we just understood what a Keren Hashar represented in the times of Chazal. So Rav Leib Gurwitz, Zatzal, related that he was once in a museum in England, and he saw a display that showed the progression of baby bottles from over the centuries. And he noticed that in previous generations, you'd feed a baby with a glass bottle. Now we use plastic. They used to use an actual glass bottle. Go back a little further, a metal can. It's amazing that children survived, right? You go back a little further beyond that, and they fed the baby from a Keren Hashor. They actually used an ox's horns to feed children, to feed a baby. It's actually explicitly in Rashi on Shabbos Taflam and Hem Beis, Dibra Maschel Vatanya, Vatanya Shofar Mitaltel, where Rashi writes, Shofar Mitaltel Lefi Shekofuf Rosho V'ro'oi Lishov Bomayim V'lishto Satinok. That the advantage of a shofar is that it's shaped in an ideal way to hold a lot of liquid and to release a little bit at a time. And it's ideally for feeding children. And that apparently was what they would use a Keren Hashar for. So it was then, said Rav Leib Gurwitz, that he understood what the Yavanim were trying to say. It was speaking allegorically when they said, Kisvu lechem al keren ha'shar she'en lechem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. It was drowning 1,000 people in a drop of ink. It meant to say that the Jewish people, the way to attack the Jewish people, the way to attack the Torah and the Mesorah of Klal Yisrael was to ingrain in children from the youngest of ages, put it in the mother's milk, put it in the baby bottles, that ein lechem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. Make that be the first message when their souls are so impressionable that they see, and to infuse that sense in them, you know, to appreciate how important those early years are in the development of a person. I was just reading the other night, I started to read the new Rav David Feinstein biography that came out. And they were describing how in his earliest childhood, it was a real problem. You weren't allowed to learn Torah. You weren't allowed to teach Torah. He happened to have known Tanakh by heart. So he and his father would like pretend that they were having conversations when they were really learning with each other, just as a way. And Rav Moshe left Luban. He felt he was the Rav. He was the person that was in charge of the whole community. Everything was going to fall apart if he left. But what made him decide to leave is that you couldn't teach children Torah. And if you can't teach children Torah, whatever, as much your Shemayim as you may try to imbue in them in the home, that's what their foundation is going to be. And he felt he had to abandon the community, which he did. He had to. Before he left, he by hand wrote them a calendar of all of the Yavim Tovim for the next like 20 years or something, which turned out not to be so useful because the Nazis came in and wiped out the whole community just a couple of years later. Baruch Hashem, Rav Moshe got out. But by hand, he wrote them a calendar just so they'll know when Yom Tov is for the next 20 years. But the reason that he left was because you have to protect the children, and that's what he did. Lekach Tov quotes the Machzeh Eliyahu that the power of the first impression is exactly what the butler had done so terribly wrong. He didn't describe Yosef improperly, but the way he described Yosef should have been. There was this amazing dream interpreter. He hit the nail on the head every time. And what was so surprising was that he was a kid. He was a Jewish kid who used to be an Eved. Like, that's how he should have started. But instead he started Nar Eved Ivri. And he immediately, Nar Ivri Eved L'Sar Taba, and he immediately painted a picture in Paro's mind. As, he's a kid. He immediately painted a picture in Paro's mind. And that's what Rashi's criticizing, that he's creating an inherent bias. Remember, I was talking to a Talmud Chacham once about a bigger Talmud Chacham, a much bigger Talmud Chacham, who was the same age as this fellow. So I'd say I'm talking to Reuven about his friend Shimon, who he went to yeshiva with. Shimon is a world-renowned, respected Talmud Chacham, mechaber of a dozen svarim, and Reuven is a guy, he's okay, he's a rabbi, he's good, right? So I'm talking to Reuven, and Reuven says, I said, do you know Shimon? He's like, he's a good boy. He's a good boy. That's jealousy talking, right? Meaning, he calls him a good, he can't say anything bad about him, there's nothing bad to say about him. He calls him a good boy because he's jealous. So he's trying to paint a picture. Yeah, he's a kid, he was a year behind me in yeshiva, like I'm the, that's jealousy, that's not, That's the Saramash. That's what he's doing. He's a Nar. You call him a Nar? No, you should say he's an Eloi. And he's even younger than I am. And that's the way to say it. But perhaps that's the common theme between the three mitzvahs that the Yavanim tried to attack. All three are important beginnings. They're important firsts. Bris Milah, of course, was the first mitzvah that the first Jew, Avraham Avinu, was commanded to do. And also the first mitzvah that all Jewish men are involved in, well before we can be involved in any other mitzvah. Not the first mitzvah Avraham was commanded to do, but it was a major mitzvah, Mesiras Nefesh, that Avraham Avinu was commanded to do. And it's the first mitzvah that we do in our lives, or that we participate in our lives. Shabbos was the first mitzvah that Kadosh Baruch Hu himself had performed by resting on the seventh day, and it also marks the beginning of each week. It's a well-known concept in Yiddishkeit that the Hashpa of the entire week draws its nourishment from the preceding Shabbos. So while Shabbos is the end of the week in Shechem Bereishis, it's also the beginning of a week. And of course, Rosh Chodesh, obviously, is the very first mitzvah Klal Yisrael is commanded in as a nation. So inherently, it represents, and aside from that, even if it wasn't the first mitzvah commanded in as a nation, it inherently represents the concept of beginnings. It is Rosh Chodesh. And that's where the Kisvu Lechem Al Keren Ashar. Go to the beginnings, go to those first impressions. Don't bother with the old people. The old people are already dedicated to Torah and to mitzvahs and whatever else. Okay, it's a losing battle. You're not gonna change people when they're old. But if you can get them when they're young and when they're still impressionable, you can somehow impact them at that stage. Ooh, that's gonna be effective. You know, so one of the points of focus on Chanukah is on this concept of new beginnings, the importance of starting things off on the right foot. And the Panovich Rav Zichron of Racha once said that an orphan is a child with no parents, but an orphaned nation is a nation with no children. Meaning, obviously, speaking in the aftermath of the Holocaust and why he was building yeshivas and building orphanages and trying to take care of children. He was the first thing he did was built an orphanage in Bnei Brak to take care of all of the Sheres HaPleita, of all of the children. So with that achrayus, that's something that's ingrained in Klal Yisrael. That more than we focus on our own Torah and our own mitzvos, sugyas and shas, whether this is the halachically the right thing to do, but we focus more on our children's Torah and mitzvah, on our children's ability to success, ability to succeed. In we put all our money into it, we put all our resources into it, we put all our efforts into it. We were speaking about it just yesterday. That you have Jews who are earning a good living. And they should be able to live in a fancy house, and they should be able to drive fancy cars and take fancy vacations, because all of their colleagues are doing that in their workplace. All their colleagues that are earning the same amount of money as them are doing those things, and they aren't. Not because they don't want to, but because all of their money is spent on educating their children and making sure that their children are in Torah. Mikam Chayisrael, that's something. That says, that's a statement of priorities, of what we think of that. Now, part of it is that we have to make sure, and this is like our achrayus here in Yeshiva, every day I'm in at least two meetings where this topic comes up, to make sure that the people teaching our children are qualified, and that there are enough people to teach our children, and that people will be willing to teach young children also, not just older children, because it's so critical to the continuity of the Jewish people, even if it's not the most lucrative profession in the world. And that's certainly got to be part of the message of Chanukah.